You wouldn't think that philosophy would be a subversive activity. I mean, really, they just sit around and think, right? This is what they do. They sit around and think. Philosophers with their long beards and their big words, how could they possibly be dangerous? And this is a common stereotype, that philosophers live in the ivory tower, apart from the practical world. That the most common phrase uttered by a philosophy major is, "Do you want fries with that?" Or probably nowadays, "Tall, grande, or venti?" Why is the smallest drink called a tall, by the way? That, it seems to me, is a question philosophy should look into. There's a great verse in a song by the Indigo Girls. "I went to see the doctor of philosophy with a poster of Rasputin and a beard down to his knee. He never did marry or see a B-grade movie. He graded my performance. He said he could see through me. I spent 4 years prostrate to the higher mind, got my paper, I was free." I have this song on a live CD of theirs, and when they sing that, "I was free," the crowd erupts into cheers. You can hear them all shouting with glee. Any of you ever feel that way about philosophy? You read Kant's Prolegomena to any future metaphysics in college, couldn't make heads or tails of it, and are glad to never hear of it again? Sorry to disappoint. I understand this feeling. It's pretty common, especially for those who have suffered through less than inspired lectures on this topic. But it will probably not surprise most of you to learn that I was a philosophy major in college. I had a professor, two of them actually, with beards down to their belly buttons, if not down to their knees. We learned about Kant and Spinoza and Aquinas and Heidegger and all the rest. My friend David and I would discuss philosophers and their critique of culture over ideas and connections, over fried eggs at the Red Apple Diner at 2 a.m. a couple times a week. That was the life, I tell you. The great thing about ministry is that it's one career where you get to keep doing philosophy and keep studying the conversation about great ideas. And yeah, sometimes it can get a little obtuse, a little abstract up there in the ivory tower. But when it does that, when it becomes language games and self-referential circularity, it betrays the purpose and the genesis of philosophy. Philosophy at its root is about education and social critique. It is about lighting the fire, not filling the pail. It is about becoming a flourishing human person. It is about the most vital and most fundamental questions of human existence. Today, I want to share with you why I think the life of the mind, the activity of thinking for thinking's sake, of asking and answering profound questions, of doing philosophy, of becoming a lifelong learner, a lifelong tender of your fire of learning, is a vital religious and human activity, and one you should engage in with seriousness and purpose. Philosophy means the love of wisdom. The love of wisdom. Sophia is wisdom, that elusive, sought-after goal, the mysterious goddess. Socrates, the paragon of philosophy, said that though everyone called him wise, he wasn't. He said he just knew what he didn't know, and this made him wiser than all others who pretended to know things they didn't actually know, who allowed their assumptions and society's assumptions to go unchallenged. So what did Socrates do? He walked around Athens and asked questions. He went up to the public relations spinmeister and said, "What is truth, anyway? What is goodness?" He went up to the general and asked, "What is courage?" He went to the artist and said, "What is beauty?" He asked questions and found the assumption in your answer and asked questions about that and asked questions about that. For this activity, Socrates was executed, sentenced to death and killed. The technical crime was corruption of the young, making them think too much. A martyr to no ideology or political movement or revolution, only to the notion that every assumption should be questioned. Philosophy is subversive. At its best, it is a radical activity which changes the course of the world. When John Locke said that governments derive their power not from gods, but from the consent of the people, and that that consent can be removed when the government is ineffective, he did not imagine that 100 years later, Thomas Jefferson would quote those words and help create this country. But that's the kind of thing that philosophy does. It creates new ideas. It brings possibility into being. It asks people to think for themselves. But careful here. Careful here. Not just to think of whatever they like, whatever floats their fancy, but to think with rigor, with knowledge and understanding of the thoughts that others have thought, to be in conversation with these sources of ancient wisdom. Philosophy is not populism. It is not whatever, go with your gut. It is rigorous thinking, designed to deepen your ability to reason. Can you go toe-to-toe with the ancients? Find the logical flaw in Aquinas' fifth proof for the existence of God? Not just assert what you feel, say, it doesn't seem right to me, but actually make a case that will stand up to debate. The purpose of philosophy, at least as Socrates understood it, is thus the same as the real purpose of education and the real purpose, as we understand it, of religion. As Rick Maston put it in that fabulous poem and Susan put it in her chalice lighting, education, when done well, isn't the ability to answer a question, but the ability to create one. Students learn when they have something they want to know about, something they want to understand, something that pulls them. My daughter's been learning to read. She's a first grader. She's been learning to read mostly so that she could learn more about dolphins and whales. It's what she wants to know about more than anything else, and she's becoming quite the expert. It's her curiosity to understand the words on the pages of the school library books that she gets on this topic that motivates her to become a better and better reader. I learned most of the math that I learned because I wanted to know how the universe worked back when I was younger and needed more math to know more about it. Curiosity motivates learning. It's the oxygen for our fire. Education should provoke us to be more curious about the world and work to help us know how to learn, how to answer our questions in ways that are sound and comprehensive and accurate. But it's that spark. Religion, in our perspective, works in much the same way. It's not my job here to teach you the truth, to tell you or to tell our children what the correct doctrines are. I don't think that would go very far here. Instead, we believe that religion is about becoming awake, becoming alive to the sense of wonder and hope and compassion which lives in every person. As our great sage Ralph Waldo Emerson put it, truly speaking, it is not instruction, but provocation that I can receive from another soul. What he announces, I must find true in me, or reject, and on his word, or as his second, be he who he may, I can accept nothing. The he to whom Emerson refers here, by the way, is Jesus. On his word or as his second, be he who he may, I can accept nothing. But I can be provoked. I can be provoked, made to consider the deepest questions, to live according to my own conscience and sense of integrity. What Emerson admires most about Jesus actually is how provocative he is, how his teachings and life make you think hard about your own life, your own values. He thought this too about Socrates and the Buddha and all great religious prophets. One of my professors in college, and this is not my professor from college, this is Rodin's Thinker, which appears in many places. This is outside the Rodin Museum in Philadelphia. One of my professors in college, a man named Tom Davis, I want to give him credit, drew a line for us in his many classes between Socrates provoking people in the Athens marketplace to Emerson's words about the soul as provocation to another soul, to the moral philosophy of Hannah Arendt. late 20th century philosopher who is his favorite philosopher, and because he inspired and provoked me to read her and grow to love her, became mine as well. Arendt studies politics, the philosophy of politics, and in particular totalitarianism and the Nazi era and the Holocaust. Her most famous book is Eichmann in Jerusalem, a study of Adolf Eichmann, who helped make the Nazi regime run. In another part of the essay from which the reading comes from this morning, Arendt asks this question: could the activity of thinking as such, the habit of examining and reflecting upon whatever comes to pass, regardless of specific content and quite independent of results, could this activity be of such a nature that it conditions men against evil doing? To put it another way, do we need to think, not know, but think our way to good action? Her critique of Eichmann is that he doesn't think. He's smart enough, he can understand things, but he doesn't think about things. He is not troubled by thoughts. He just goes with the social custom of his environment. Thinking is necessary for good, and Arendt's argument is this: that when you're engaging in thinking, for the sake of thinking, the life of the mind, to question assumptions and wonder about what things mean, doing this usually involves an internal dialogue. Huh, that's interesting, you think, as a thought goes by. That's an interesting thought. What does that mean? And you inquire about yourself. What could it mean? Could it mean this? Does it mean this? We ask ourselves questions in our own mind. And because we've read literature and had conversations with others and studied the ancient wisdom, we think about what would they think about it. So we have more voices that we're hearing, engaging in our own internal conversation. And in doing this, thinking, it's thus practice for using our conscience. Our conscience literally meaning with knowing. With knowing, and is connected both etymologically and philosophically with the word consciousness. To become aware of oneself, to see, I have thoughts. I am a person, I have thoughts. One's thoughts, to study them, is to learn to use your conscience. To become conscious of yourself is to learn to use your conscience, to think about your actions, to break free of social norms, to think and live a life of integrity, of righteousness and beauty. I can teach you all the codes, all the rules, but what will you do when you encounter a situation we didn't discuss? You need conscience, the ability to think, to figure it out. I can teach you every fact in the book, but that's just filling the pail. If you haven't lit the fire of curiosity, then you might know what was, but you'll never be able to learn about what is becoming, which is a much more important thing to do. I can teach you doctrines and rituals, but it is the provocation of the spirit, the encounter with mystery, of living and loving the questions, that is the true religious and spiritual life. The life of the mind, of thinking about things for no practical reason, is thus recommended to you. As a practice of ethics and education and spirituality, to think with creative freedom and in dialogue with the great ones, this is the life of meaning and purpose and beauty. The parable I told as the story for all ages this morning is, as some of you probably recognized, an adapted, highly adapted version of Plato's famous allegory of the cave. So for those of you who don't know or don't remember that story, it's a little more brutal than the version I told this morning. The people are chained with their heads so they can only see the wall in front of them. And behind them, railing and the shadow puppets in front of the fire are moved, and they see only the shadows on the wall. They have no idea the rest of the world even exists. One is freed and departs. And if you remember, if you know this, When he is freed from the cave and he comes out into the sun, he is blinded by the light. He can see nothing at first. It is too much. It takes time. It's painful to be in the presence of subversive and challenging thoughts. It's hard and difficult to have all your assumptions questioned. And remember, if you know it, that when he returns to free his fellows from the cave, they reject his heresy. What do you mean these are just shadows? This is all we know. How could it be so that this isn't real? Socrates himself pays the price of his life for such teaching. His student Plato is here reminding us. It is dangerous. Some don't want to come to the light, don't want to examine and change their assumptions. The life of the mind is disruptive. It doesn't belong in the ivory tower. It is properly the work of every person to tend the fire of their own soul and mind. It's hard work, but as Socrates put it 2,300 years ago, the unexamined life is not worth living. Or to put it positively, despite all the challenges, the examined life, the life of conscience and the love of wisdom, such a life is the only life worth living, the only way to honor the gift of life itself. So we pray, we sing, we think, we wonder, we become awake and aware. We ask ourselves questions, we ask others questions, and we in this way become most fully and beautifully alive. We're going to sing together. It's 298 in your gray hymnal if you want the music. Words up here, "Wake now my senses," and I invite you to rise in body or in spirit.